This is the second part of a two-part episode. I strongly encourage you to listen to the first part before listening to this one, because I'll be making certain assertions in this episode that might sound extreme or maybe overly political if you haven't heard that first part first. The first section discusses the concepts of conspiracy theory and their historical roots. It traces the history of antisemitism in Europe and the history of apocalyptic thought in evangelicalism. We just looked at the creation and the spread of a forgery, a document called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, from Russia to Germany in the 1920s. Now we're going to cross the Atlantic and see how the protocols influence thought in America. Henry Ford published a newspaper that was distributed at all Ford dealerships, called the Dearborn Independent. In 1920, a series of articles began to be published, alerting the reader of the Jewish menace, several of which discuss and reprint sections of the protocols. Interestingly, as the protocols began to circulate in the English language, references to the Jews were often replaced with references to Bolsheviks. Several Dearborn Independent articles discuss a conspiracy between Bolsheviks and Jews. At the same time, in 1921, the Times of London published the conclusive debunk of the protocols. It showed that the 24 protocols were virtually the same as the 25 steps that Machiavelli lays out in A Dialogue in Hell. This was followed by a book laying bare the non-Jewish sources for that text. Over the next few years, Ford's Dearborn Independent articles were compiled into a series of books, the first of which was entitled The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. These books contained articles such as, Does Jewish Power Control World Press? Are the Jews Victims or Persecutors? Jewish Idea Molded Federal Reserve Plan? And Will Jewish Zionism Bring Armageddon? If some of these theories sound familiar to you, then congrats, you've been paying attention. In 1927, at least partially for business reasons, Ford closed down the newspaper and issued an apology to the Jewish community. The apology was written by others and was never signed by Ford. As late as 1940, he expressed his intention to publish The International Jew again once anti-Nazi sentiment had died down. Ford managed to stop the reprinting of The International Jew through lawsuits, but this was one of those Pandora's box ideas. This idea wasn't going back in the box. Hitler wrote, "Every year makes the American Jews more and more the controlling masters of the producers in a nation of 150 million, referring to the U.S. Only a single great man, Ford, to their fury, still maintains full independence." Its seed was planted on fertile ground. America had been home to xenophobic movements virtually since its founding. Alexander Hamilton, himself an immigrant from the Caribbean, was an early nativist. He campaigned for Adams's Alien and Sedition Acts, which discouraged immigration by raising citizenship requirements. When few people were deported under the acts, Hamilton railed, quote, "Renegade aliens conduct more than one of the most incendiary presses in the United States, and yet, in open contempt and defiance of the laws, they are permitted to continue their destructive labors. Why are they not sent away?" In the 1820s and 30s, the first major third party appeared in the United States, the Anti-Masonic Party. In 1854, the Know-Nothing Party captured the speakership of the House, and the Know-Nothing Party's goals were to uncover the Catholic conspiracy that was destroying the nation and to reduce immigration. The term nativist was first used as an insult to Know-Nothings. They were decried as bigoted nativists in the press. Nativist here, of course, does not refer to Native Americans, by the way. It refers to the children of the original colonies. As Hamilton shows us, even immigrants want to close the door after they've come in. America was also fertile ground for apocalyptic prophecies. William Miller was a Baptist minister who devised a system of biblical numerology to determine when the millennium of the end times would come. He determined that the second coming of Christ would occur on October 22nd, 1844. This event came to be known as the Great Disappointment. Many left the church or Christianity entirely, but others formulated the Millerite milieu into the Seventh-day Adventists and the Jehovah's Witnesses, among other churches. Elements in the Jehovah's Witnesses have formulated several other dates for the Second Coming, most recently in 1975, but as of the time of writing this podcast, no end times have yet been observed. And you better believe that I'll be talking about the Millerites in a future episode. In the 1920s, this seed, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, germinated in America. Two writers began to synthesize all of these ideas I've been discussing into the first recognizably modern conspiracy theories. Their names were Nesta Webster and Lady Queensborough. Nesta Webster was the wealthy daughter of an English banker. She began her writing career after she read the letters of a countess involved in the French Revolution and realized that she was the reincarnation of someone who was alive during the Revolution. Her first book explains how a Masonic plot caused the French Revolution and continues to disrupt the world up to our own time. In the 20s, she published a series of articles on the protocols, which she claimed revealed not only the Jewish plot, but a deeper, more secret Masonic plot to take over the world. She managed to merge several strains of Anglo-Protestant xenophobia into one idea. She claimed that the Jesuits, which are a Catholic missionary society, the Freemasons, the Jews, and the Bolsheviks were all part of the same organization called the Illuminati. The Illuminati was a short-lived Bavarian secular society that set its goal to freeing the world from political and religious domination, founded in 1776. Within 11 or 12 years, it was dissolved by various powers within Germany that were threatened by its aims. Or was it? Yes, it was. However, its enemies almost immediately claimed that the organization lived on in secret, double secret. Its supposed connections to the French Revolution, which had similar aims and happened shortly after the dissolution of the Illuminati, allowed Webster to hitch her pet conspiracy theories to this incoming wave of anti-Semitism. Her work was highly celebrated by British fascist organizations. Lady Queensborough, Edith Starr Miller, held similar views. She was a New York socialite, the daughter of an industrialist and real estate tycoon. Her view was even more stark. She saw history as being controlled by secret societies, but she had a clear idea of how that control was maintained, through money. She wrote, quote, "This power is wholly in the hands of international Jewish financiers." For her, the Illuminati were merely one of the many arms of the Jewish conspiracy. Quote, "Illuminism represented the efforts of the heads of the powerful Jewish Kahal, which has ever striven for the attainment of political, financial, economic, and moral world domination." At this point, the main ideas that form today's conspiracy theories had all arrived on the American intellectual landscape. The secret rule of the world by conspiracies? Check. The connection between banks, Jews, Catholics, Masons, Communists, and the Illuminati? Check. The impending apocalypse, rise of the Antichrist, and the creation of a new world order? Check. The streams had begun to flow together, and their combined explanatory power became a raging river. Barkin points out the apparent elegance of the conspiracy theory milieu. In science, an idea is considered parsimonious if it is simple and has great explanatory power. This test is called Occam's Razor. What's the simplest explanation that explains all the evidence? Well, these conspiracy theories are nothing if not parsimonious. One adversary is to blame for all the evil in the world, and all things that happen are due to its influence. How could anyone explain more with less? So far, I've used a couple of analogies to explain intellectual history. I've talked about it as a seed on fertile ground. I've talked about streams becoming a river. In this next section, I want you to imagine a drawing in Sharpie on a balloon that's being blown up. As it stretches, the figure becomes bigger, but also more diffuse, less distinct. So if you think that Webster and Queensborough created an exaggerated image of how the world works, just listen to the writers that followed them. So if you think that the Illuminati, with its creation date in 1776, feels too late in history to explain everything that happens in history, fear not. These thinkers had the anti-Semitic tradition to draw from. They had 2,000 years of work. As Illuminati theories merged more and more with Christian millennialism, the scope and control of the world by secret societies expanded. By connecting the organization with evil in general, it becomes a code word rather than a historical organization. And by freeing itself from the founding date, the term Illuminati becomes a shorthand for any organization led by evil goals. So, by the time we get to Jim Keith and David Icke, Illuminati has just become a generic term for satanic or primordial evil that has existed and controlled the world since time immemorial. But how is this accomplished? In the post-World War II world, anti-Semitism had lost most of its currency in the West. Anti-Jewish theories had lost their status as a legitimate wing of the then-thriving pseudoscience of race, and had become a grisly specter of war, a reminder of the horrors that become possible when a people is robbed of its humanity. Even worse for conspiracy theorists, the debunking of the protocols in 1921 had become largely accepted, not only by academics and journalists, but by the general public. It's worth noting that the protocols, though, is still used as a genuine text by mainstream figures in the Arab world to this day. English-speaking conspiracy theorists needed to transcend the anti-Semitism on which their ideas were based. Des Griffin accomplished this in 1975 by inverting the protocols, by claiming that while the Jews are important participants in the plot to subvert and conquer the world, the protocols blames the Jews to protect the Illuminati. Griffin reprinted most of the protocols verbatim, launching what would become a staple of conspiracism in the 90s, the idea of the Illuminati protocols. In fact, he used the same trick that Henry Ford used. Whereas in the 20s, references to Jews were replaced with references to Bolsheviks, in the 70s, they were replaced with references to the Illuminati. This state change, from a solid building block idea to liquid hate that can fill any conspiracy structure it meets, allowed American conspiracy theory to retain anti-Semitic ideas while shedding anti-Semitic forms. In the 1970s, John Todd, an evangelical preacher and sometime witch, incorporated nearly every authority in America into one grand conspiracy. I'm going to quote Barkin again here. He said that Todd believed, quote, "The Illuminati allegedly worked its will largely by wielding financial power, led by the Rothschilds, but aided by, among others, the Rockefeller, Kennedy, and DuPont families, the major banks of England, France, and the United States, the world copper market, and many major corporations. The Council of 13, which Todd claimed to have been a member, executed decisions of the Rothschild Tribunal through its control of churches, political institutions, and voluntary associations. Thus, among the lackeys were the World Council of Churches, the Anti-Defamation League, the Council on Foreign Affairs, the United Nations, the FBI, the CIA, the Communist Party, the John Birch Society, the American Civil Liberties Union, the Masons, and the Knights of Columbus. In Todd's mind, the Illuminati were Satan's coordinating mechanism, through which diabolical forces insinuated themselves into virtually every aspect of American life." End quote. What ties these groups together? Say it with me, people. Internationalists, bankers, intellectuals, elites. The inclusion of the John Birch Society in this list again speaks to the incredible heterodoxy of thinkers like Todd. The John Birch Society was founded in 1958 by Robert Welch specifically to spread conspiracy theories. Quoting Barkin, the John Birch Society, quote, "dismisses the supposed suppression of the Illuminati as meaningless, contending that it was soon transplanted to both the United States and other parts of Europe, where it gave rise to the Communist Manifesto and the revolts of 1848. The Burchite retelling attributes to the Illuminati the creation of movements as varied as the Marxian and Utopian socialist movements, anarchism, pan-Slavism, Irish, Italian, and German nationalism, German imperialism, the French Commune, British New Imperialism, Fabian Socialism, and Leninist Bolshevism. End quote. Up to this point, super conspiracy theory has stayed on the fringe of society, generally shunned by mainstream media and thinkers. In 1990 and 91, that changed for three reasons. First, the USSR was dissolved, and Russia abandoned communism. Up to this point, most American conspiracy theories had pitted good against evil, and did so along the lines that we've been discussing. That is, America is a God-fearing nation based on individual rights and freedom and private property, whereas Russia is a godless nation based on authority and internationalism and public property. In the wake of the USSR's defeat, this evil lost its physical center. Without a location and an organization to center on, this evil suddenly becomes much more diffuse and subtle. Second, President George H.W. Bush gave a speech about the post-Cold War future, in which he calls for a new world order. The concept to which George Bush was referring was not the conspiracy theory. Bush was referring to an idea coined by Woodrow Wilson as World War I was winding down. Wilson hoped to create a new world order that was safe for democracy, by creating internationalist alliances in countries that could prevent wars and intercede on behalf of democratic movements. A key component of this was to be the League of Nations, which found itself toothless when Congress declined to commit America to the organization. The idea was revived by FDR and Kennedy in the wake of World War II, and the creation of the United Nations, the Marshall Plan, the IMF, and NATO were all intended to knit the democratic world together. I think they've been fairly effective in that pursuit. These bodies, not coincidentally, are often pointed to by conspiracy theorists as the tools of this New World Order conspiracy. Finally, in 1990, both President Bush and President Gorbachev gave speeches calling for a New World Order of peace and stability in the post-Soviet world. Essentially, Bush was using the term to refer to a new era in American hegemony. In a world without Soviet opposition, the U.S. was accepting the sole responsibility of protecting sovereignty, resolving disputes, and guiding global development. He soon made good on this promise by intervening in the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. However, to conspiracy theorists, this term was already well developed, and far-right circles caught fire with fears that the American president had publicly announced his commitment to the cabal. Third, Pat Robertson published his book, entitled The New World Order. In this, we find what I would call the mature conspiracy theory milieu. As a popular evangelical preacher, Robertson fully brought the dispensationalist concept of the Antichrist and the Apocalypse into harmony with conceptions of this Illuminati cabal. American Christian millennialists had been preaching about a coming apocalypse caused by open war between the US and USSR centered on Israel. But suddenly, both the threat of an impending confrontation and the pressure on Israel in foreign policy decreased. Without an imminent catastrophe on the horizon, Christian millennialists had to turn to their brothers in conspiracy to fill that void. The anti-Semitism inherent in the concept of the Antichrist and that inherent in the idea of the Illuminati world order fit hand in glove. The power of Pat Robertson's The New World Order lay not in its originality. After all, it introduced very few new ideas, but in its reach. Pat Robertson was a pioneer of televangelism. He built a small regional television station into the Christian Broadcasting Network, which is broadcast in 180 countries and is now owned by Disney. He ran for president in 1988 in a primary against George Bush and Bob Dole, and managed to come second in Iowa before his campaign lost steam. Even so, he managed to win a plurality of the primary vote in four states. He ran on a platform of fairly standard evangelical beliefs for the time, banning pornography, eliminating the Department of Education, and balancing the budget. The point is, he was respected and a fairly mainstream figure in both religion and politics when his 1991 book came out. It was carried by major booksellers, and it was a New York Times bestseller. It alleged that a conspiracy had perverted the world, starting with the Masons and the Illuminati, through the French Revolution, through communist Russia, and now had an eye towards taking down the U.S. It came out on the heels of a speech by his successful rival, George Bush, announcing a New World Order to the world. This is how we get the crystallized idea around which the alt-right of today is formed. All the powers that be are conspiring together, and have been through all of history, and the American government is in on it. Now, before I reach the apotheosis of this podcast, let's zoom out for a moment. I've been very focused on how anti-Semitic and Christian conspiracy theories entered right-wing politics. But conspiracy theory, and in particular stigmatized knowledge claims, are popular on the left too. Do you have any thoughts on how we might spot conspiracy theories in a time when truth itself seems to be partisan?
Oh, that's a very tough question. Obviously, the current pandemic is a test of this, and it will be interesting to see whether, in a way, the media, or at least the major media, recover some of their authority as a result of the pandemic. Because, of course, in this kind of crisis, there is an enormous thirst for reliable information.
Do you have any tips or ideas on how ordinary people who aren't academics, can help with preventing the spread of misinformation and helping with re-solidifying this idea of truth that we can all agree on?
That's an even tougher question. I'm not sure that as it's posed, it's answerable. I think really the best way that this issue can be addressed is if young people can be trained in their education to think critically about information and its sources, so that when they reach adulthood, they're capable of making informed choices about information and where it comes from.
When we look closely, the line between conspiracy theory and pseudoscience is hard to determine. All manner of theories fall under the heading of things they force on us to hide the truth, including GMOs, vaccines, cancer treatments, processed food, news media, global warming, and probably most famously, the moon landing. Consider Alex Jones again, a man who believes that the powers that be are stealing nature from us, while at the same time opposing the EPA. This is the heterodoxy that I was talking about earlier. These ideas are more anti-authoritarian than they are leftist or rightist. What is particularly frustrating is that the agencies that work hardest for people get the lion's share of the blame. FEMA, the American Emergency Response Agency, has been accused of building concentration camps to house abducted anti-authoritarians that are picked up in black helicopters. The World Health Organization, which is currently working tirelessly to stem the spread of coronavirus, is blamed with falsifying basically all of Western medicine. NASA, which has pushed back the frontiers of human ignorance countless times, is blamed about the shape of the Earth. Which lets me get to a favorite factoid of mine. John Quincy Adams, the 6th president of the United States and the son of John Adams, a famously intellectual president who wanted to build a national observatory to be a, quote, lighthouse to the skies, believed in the hollow earth at least enough to support a hollow earth lecturer. This movement in the 1820s and 30s believed that portals at the North and South Pole led to a warm and populated subterranean realm. We can perhaps be more kind to this movement, which existed when Earth science was in its infancy, than we can with flat earthers of today. We've actually seen an explosion in flat earth claims in recent years, which is particularly startling since virtually every people in every time in the history of civilization knew the earth was round. The idea that Europeans thought the earth was flat is a myth, by the way, and I particularly like the Norse proof, The Norse said that if the earth was flat, then there could be no sunrise or sunset because shadows of things at the edges would cover the whole world. Flat earth is so easy to disprove that all you need is to stand with a ruler at a shorefront. And yet, there are people today earnestly claiming that NASA and science at large is falsifying the shape of the earth. Similarly, the idea that vaccines cause autism has been completely debunked. In 1998, Andrew Wakefield published a paper in The Lancet, which is one of the most esteemed peer-reviewed medical journals out there, which linked the MMR vaccine to autism. In 2004, his financial conflicts of interest were unearthed, and in 2010, The Lancet issued a full retraction of the paper on the grounds that the manuscript was falsified. And yet, despite this, the anti-vax movement has flourished in America, and measles and mumps deaths have rebounded. And now, I want to quickly address UFOs. It might sound like I'm moving into increasingly fringe territory here, but actually the opposite is true. As of a 2019 survey, 33% of Americans believe that we have contacted aliens, and 68% believe that the government is hiding information about aliens. UFO believers are not fringe people. UFO believers are predominantly white, middle-class, male college graduates with incomes just below the median. Does that sound like the demographic for any politician you've heard of recently? Belief in UFO theories does not make someone a conspiracy theorist automatically, but there is significant overlap with theories about government cover-ups. As I mentioned at the beginning, this was my own point of entry into conspiracy theory literature. This suspicion of public institutions feeds the popularity of conspiracy theories. Since the 90s, Pew surveys have found declining favorable public feelings towards Congress, federal agencies, both the major political parties, financial institutions, large corporations, the national news media, and the entertainment industry. Again, this does not make us a conspiracist nation, but it has accompanied a mainstreaming of conspiracy theories and the rise of fringe theories in popularity. Presumably, distrust increases the pool of people who are open to conspiracy and fringe theories.
Well, first of all, do you think that's a trend that's likely to continue? You mentioned possibly with the pandemic that that could change.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that's at least hopeful about the pandemic is that scientific and medical figures seem to have retained their authority. At least for the bulk of the population. It has certainly affected expectations about government. And you know, the process of loss of faith has been going on for a long time, and this is not something that happened overnight. It's been going on really since the late 60s and early 70s. So it's been going on for decades really affected more than one generation.
Yeah, because certainly the environment I was raised in was very skeptical of all kinds of authority. And there was a lot of talk of, well, this presents new opportunity for, you know, with the internet coming up, for journalists to be able to make their own name and to not have to rely on the traditional gatekeepers of media. So I can kind of see it both ways. Do you think there's value in still having these gatekeepers to the mainstream?
Yes. No. You know, if you go back to 1970, maybe even a little later, you realize the power of gatekeepers. Because if you go back to that point, you had three major networks with their news broadcasts and their anchors. You had two major news magazines. You had a few major newspapers and basically one wire service, gatekeepers in the form of editors of one sort or another basically controlled the flow of news and information. Now, of course, you know, there's still some gatekeepers, obviously, but there are all sorts of platforms where information can flow relatively free of gatekeepers, and that levels the playing field. And you can say, well, isn't that wonderful? Because all kinds of fresh ideas and pieces of information that previously were filtered out can find a way to reach an audience and sometimes a mass audience. On the other hand, all kinds of ideas that are potentially highly dangerous can reach a large audience, and that is not necessarily a social good. While the playing field has been leveled, there are pluses and minuses.
It seems to tie into also if you are someone who believes that all major sources of information are in cahoots with these negative aims for society. I could see how you would say, well, any gatekeeper then can be corrupt, and gatekeepers are trying to direct the conversation in a certain way. I guess, is there any way around that? Is there any way for us to have objective, trustable gatekeepers for news and that kind of thing? Is that just a thing of the past?
Well, sure, you can have trustworthy gatekeepers, assuming that they have the requisite values and institutional loyalties. I mean, if you look at newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, they've been able to maintain those values over relatively long periods of time. And hopefully they'll continue to do that. And they seem to be able to continue to do that even in an atmosphere with enormous technological changes.
Yeah. And being called fake news on a weekly basis by the President of the United States.
Yeah, precisely. Again, hopefully, you know, they'll be able to continue to do that, as you say, even in a relatively hostile political climate. Now, whether there are enough sources of information that are comparable in their integrity, you know, I don't know. I think there are, but not a great many.
Hey, by the way, does anyone remember 2012? Many seemingly rational people were talking about this global apocalypse. As a history lover, I found this phenomenon particularly frustrating. Rising from left-wing New Age circles, a current of thought hit the mainstream that suggested that Mayans had predicted the end of the world in 2012. This was inspired by, like the anti-vax movements, a single academic paper that claimed that the apocalypse would occur on December 25th, 2011. This is because the longest unit of time in the Mayan calendar, the Bactun, lasts for approximately 5,200 years. This is almost certainly inspired by the Christian idea of the millennium, which is the longest traditional unit of time and has its apocalyptic associations. This paper was published in 1966, and in the intervening years, two schools of thought developed. One saw the Mayan apocalypse as a spiritual rebirth, and the other as a literal cataclysm. The theory gained significant mainstream attention with Roland Emmerich's 2009 film, 2012. In fact, scholarship has found that Mayans had no apocalyptic associations with the Bactun. It wasn't even their longest unit of time, we have since discovered. Adherents discovered what the Millerites discovered in 1844. It's not a very good idea to put a specific date on your apocalypse. The frustrating thing that 2012 shows us is that this intense interest in the Mayan calendar did nothing to spur popular research into Mayans. People did not use it as an entry point to learn about culture. They only appropriated the supposedly mystical aspects of the Mayans. This goes back to that issue of context. If you want to take another culture's idea, whether it be a foreign culture's or one from your own culture's past,
At least take a little time to learn about the context, please. A great popularizer of this Mayan myth was a person I've mentioned a few times now, David Icke. He was a sportscaster for BBC, but when they parted on unfriendly terms, he became a spokesman for the Green Party. This relationship ended after Icke's spiritual awakening in 1990 and 91, when he saw a spiritual healer and later visited Peru, where he realized that he needed to help the world through an imminent apocalypse. This translated into a career as a conspiracist author. He has taken the Illuminati idea of world control all the way back to the beginning of humanity and even further. Seemingly an interpolation of the ancient aliens idea, he posits that some human bloodlines merged with those of transdimensional aliens, and these reptilian human hybrids continue to secretly rule the world today. Along with this synthesis of alien and Illuminati theories, he also interpolates ideas of vibrational energies, ley lines, the aforementioned Mayan calendar, and anti-consumerist messages, which are mostly ideas that are traditionally left-wing. Somewhat predictably, he also vouches for the Protocols of the Elders of Zion as a true document about the Illuminati. He identifies its authorship as Rothschilds and reptilian Aryans, which somehow fuses Nazis and Jews into the same conspiracy. This is how David Icke is able to pass in both the Crystals crowd and the Preppers crowd. And now we've reached a point of total synthesis. From evangelicals to neo-pagans, from preppers to ufologists, a large community in America believes something is up. But what that something is can vary widely, but elements remain stable. The enemy is unknowable, the conspiracy unprovable, the evil is ubiquitous. Whether they be the usual suspects, our internationalists, bankers, intellectuals, elites, or a deeper primordial evil, the evil forces rule with an iron but invisible hand. In keeping with the Antichrist narrative, deliverance can only come from a great upheaval in the world system, a great leader who can expose the evil machinery for what it is. Believers require a Messiah.
There's nobody bigger or better at the military than I am.
I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me. I know more about courts than any human being on earth.
Because I have a very good brain.
I know words. I have the best words.
Nobody but me will know how to do. I'm the king of banking. Oh, am I good at banking? Do I know how to deal with banks?
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
I find Trump's status as a savior difficult to explain. He is a millionaire New York realtor and a businessman. Millionaire New York realtors, not historically seen as incorruptible public saviors. The only explanation I can find for this reputation is his intimate relationship with conspiracy theory. Donald J. Trump arrived on the political scene in 2012 with a series of tweets and videos informed by right-wing conspiracy theory. In particular, he repeatedly demanded to see Barack Obama's birth certificate. This was part of a conspiracy theory that posited that Barack Obama was born outside the U.S. and therefore wasn't eligible to be president. This was called the birther conspiracy theory. The great irony of this theory was that it began during the 2008 election, and while Obama was conclusively proven to be born in Hawaii, McCain was actually born off base in Panama. And so actually McCain might not be a natural-born citizen. I defy you, listener, to try and figure out what natural-born citizen is. It seems like the only thing everyone agrees on is that Arnold Schwarzenegger is definitely not natural-born citizen. Everything else, very cloudy. Trump has paradoxically claimed that Obama's eventual release of his birth certificate was a victory for birthers, and has never apologized for his participation in this racist attack on Obama's legitimacy. I think by now I've presented enough evidence to say conspiracy theories are a way for people in the center of society to distance people on the fringes of society. It allows the center to complain that it's under attack while attacking outsiders. Michael Barkin, writing in 2013, notes Trump's conspiracy theory heritage. Quote, "While the resilience of birther notions owes something to zealots, they have also been the beneficiary of higher-profile figures. Donald Trump has been among the best known of such individuals. And while he is not a political figure per se, his occasional presidential aspirations, together with his zest for public notice and his private means, have given him access to media attention. Trump was featured on Alex Jones' show in 2015, a show which Jones now regrets, as mentioned earlier. The following year, he claimed that Ted Cruz's father was implicated in the JFK assassination. Why would Trump do that? Because he knows who he's talking to. He's appealing to the Steve Bannons and the Alex Joneses, who can depict him as an anti-establishment figure, despite a long career as a realtor and a celebrity.
So when you updated A Culture of Conspiracy in 2013, I believe that's when you added the section about Donald Trump and the birther conspiracy?
That's right, yes.
So I was wondering, did you pay special attention to Trump during the 2016 election? And was there a moment when you realized that it was going to be different from 2012 or previous elections that Donald Trump has been involved in?
Oh, yes. His involvement in the birther conspiracy theories was interesting in itself because he was really the first significant public figure to associate himself with the birther theory. And then when you get to the 2016 campaign, it becomes even more significant, not because of the birther theory itself, but because Trump and his surrogates and acolytes really are the first representatives of a major modern political party to utilize fringe ideas in a presidential campaign. So the theory is in a sense emblematic of a process in which fringe ideas into the mainstream on a scale that really had not been seen in modern American politics.
Have you seen that trend continue over the last 4 years while he has been president? Do you think he's continued to stay close to his conspiracy roots?
Oh, absolutely. There's a continued sense that he sees the world in terms of plots, generally, of course, directed at him personally. Now, he doesn't seem to speak in terms of some single coherent conspiracy, but I think there is a tendency on his part to see a world in terms of plots. And of course, most recently, one sees this in terms of his notion of the deep state. This is simply the latest version of a Trump conspiracy.
So now we finally get to the question that I posed at the beginning. Why does Trump claim that he is being undermined by a deep state? What is a deep state? It's when national decisions are made by people who are not considered legitimate politicians and are not held accountable for their decisions. In order to unpack this idea, we need to think about how power is executed in a state. Even in the most democratic countries in the world, significant power is wielded by private citizens and corporations. In the U.S., infinite private funding for political campaigns has been legitimized by the Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United, which found that money is free speech and therefore can't be limited during elections. Over 90% of U.S. House representatives who won their elections raised more money than their election opponent. This doesn't mean that elections are bought, there are complicating factors, but money does influence elections. It also influences policy in the form of lobbying, which is an institutionally acceptable form of bribery, where private actors influence policy by applying their financial and electoral support in ways that benefit politicians. This also creates the so-called revolving door, where many retired politicians work in the private sector as lobbyists. Furthermore, much of the institutional oversight of industry regulations is performed by those industries themselves.
The American Bar Association and the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, are two of the best-known self-regulatory organizations. On one hand, who else could oversee the complexities of banking and law other than bankers and lawyers? But on the other, you're tasking industries with upholding regulations that potentially threaten them. Conflicts of interest are built into the system. Then you have the influence of non-politician personalities like celebrities, moguls, and media company owners like Rupert Murdoch. They participate in steering the public will through the media. None of these would be considered deep state actors, because these are all legitimate legal parts of the American political system, like them or not. So what is a deep state? A deep state is also different from that Illuminati idea we've been discussing, and they can really exist. The term was coined by Turks to refer to behind-the-scenes, unelected state officials who have a strong influence on the government. Discussion of the deep state began in 1974, when the then prime minister looked into a scandal involving the Special Warfare Department. The general running the department apparently told him it was best for members of the Republic not to look too deeply into military affairs. Since then, other scandals, assassinations, and coups have revealed connections between the military, the paramilitary, and organized crime networks in Turkey. Specifically, whistleblowers and investigators into military matters tend to die. It appears that this deep state is a descendant of Ottoman-era secret societies and Cold War-era anti-communist clandestine forces that were funded by the U.S. As I said earlier, many conspiracies are real, and they do influence politics. In the case of Turkey, entrenched, unelected officials with military and paramilitary backing do appear to control the government to some extent. A somewhat more subtle example existed during the Weimar Republic in Germany between the wars, which fits so well with the themes of this podcast. The German state was collapsing at the end of World War I, and mutinies had begun with the navy, so the monarchy and the military leadership knew that the German people would demand a new government soon. So, they planted the seeds for a counter-revolution. They handed over power to a Republican government, which then had to attempt to negotiate a peace while the country rapidly deteriorated. Army leaders made sure the country knew that it had been the Republic that signed the disastrous Treaty of Versailles. The army, in a much reduced state, held on to key political positions and occasionally demanded the appointment of conservative ministers, while generally advocating for a totalitarian takeover of the economy to fix the spiraling depression. In a way, this plan both backfired and succeeded. Political interference led to increased radicalization of the electorate, which allowed the National Socialists to gain a plurality in the Reichstag. The Nazis then created their totalitarian military socialist state. But the traditional army, the Reichswehr, found itself replaced by the Nazi brown shirts and later the SS. So while the Reichswehr succeeded, they were also excluded from power as their plan took place. All the while, both the military and Nazi leaders popularized a myth that liberal Republicans and communists had stabbed the military in the back, giving up an unnecessary and humiliating defeat in World War I. Once these forces were purged, the Jewish conspiracy theory took center stage. So this is a case where people with secret power used conspiracy theory to make themselves seem threatened by people who actually had no power. This is exactly how conspiracy theory is being used in the U.S. today. The deep state that Trump is talking about is not a deep state in the Turkish or German sense. Whenever Trump's spokespeople are questioned about the term, they immediately clarify that Trump is talking about the hostile bureaucracy in Washington. Not something like the Illuminati, not a military conspiracy. The deep state that Trump imagines is a conspiracy between left-leaning career bureaucrats, the media and entertainment industries, and a shadowy, nameless group of string pullers. Since his administration began, he has been railing against leakers and disloyal members of his administration that he needs to ferret out. These are the deep state actors that he points to. And how does he popularize this campaign? Through a media outlet that uses virtually identical language as the president. Fox Punditry creates a closed information loop between the administration and the media. And why does he do this?
so that even as he passes legislation like a budget providing huge tax cuts to large corporations and the very rich, he can claim to be a hounded underdog, slugging it out in Washington for the little guy. It's textbook conspiracy theory, the center playing victim to grab power. To quote Nancy McEldowney, a former U.S. diplomat, quote, "To refer to career civil servants in the U.S. government as some form of deep state is a clear attempt to delegitimize voices of disagreement." But I ask you this, can we really believe that Trump is talking about the American civil service when he says deep state, as his spokespeople claim? Or is this like when he joked about Ted Cruz being associated with the Kennedy assassination? Or when he jokes about foreign interference in this year's election? Trump has found great power in casting himself as the victim of liberal conspiracy. Remember, he made his appearance in politics as a conspiracy theorist. And who does he seek to defeat? The disloyal diplomats, the mean celebrities, the overeducated liberals, and even the Federal Reserve. He looks to defeat the internationalists, the bankers, the intellectuals, and the elites. It's the same trick right-wing populists have been pulling for a century. It's naked scapegoating. It's Trump appealing to his conspiracy theorist backers to defend him from the opposition. It's a way of feeding the administration's news service. It's a conspiracy, and it needs to be exposed.
This is speculation, obviously, but do you think future Republican leaders will try and steer the party back towards more mainstream ideas, or do you see this fringe stuff, and particularly the deep state stuff, becoming a staple of the Republican Party?
Well, I would hope that a post-Trump Republican Party would go back to its roots. One can't, of course, predict with any assurance, but my guess is that a post-Trump Republican Party will be a far more conventional party, and hopefully a less conspiracist party.
So during impeachment, I didn't go into impeachment much in the script since it was basically still ongoing while I was writing that script. But it seemed to me that it was essentially a trial of two conspiracy theories. Democrats were alleging that Trump had been working with unofficial diplomats and to undermine Biden in the upcoming election, while Republicans were alleging that Biden was doing some corrupt dealings with the Ukrainians. Did you see that trial as a couched in terms of conspiracies?
I think you're right. I think there was even another conspiracy theory operating, namely a belief on the part of some Republicans that there was a Democratic conspiracy directed against the president, and that in a sense the whole impeachment process was a conspiracy. It seems to me that the facts were fairly clear, unlike some situations where there are conspiracy theories that are essentially non-falsifiable. But I think in this case, the facts were fairly clear and substantial, so that whatever one's conclusions could be fact-based. So I don't think the issue was one of an absence of evidence, but rather the question of the inferences that one drew from the evidence.
I think that last point by Barkin there is the idea that I want you to take away from this episode. Almost all of this episode has been about the inquiry into how the world works and how that inquiry can go wrong. I think conspiracy theory is an intellectual dead end because its blanket explanation for evil doesn't give us meaningful insight into how the world works. The New World Order, Illuminati protocols, worldview still stands in the mind even if many or even all of its claims are disproven. This is the result of those closed logic loops I keep referencing. But speaking as someone who emerged from a worldview that was based on many closed logic loops, I can say that at least for me, investigating the truth planted the seeds of doubt that I needed to start questioning that larger belief structure. I'm reminded of the tagline of the most popular conspiracy theory TV show, The X-Files, when they say the truth is out there. There are many things that we can never know. As I said at the beginning, about Ezekiel and God's chariots, we can't know where that inspiration came from. But there are many, many things that we can know. When we're talking about the currents of history, the events that we have clear evidence of, or observable things about the world, like the facts of science, you can find truth. I'm someone who dedicates a large part of his time to researching the truth and attempting to explain it in an understandable and unbiased way. When the truth can be known, I want to know it. I feel like I have a duty to. I feel like it's worth my time to do so. So that's what I'm trying to do here, and I hope discussing conspiracy theory gives you a little more insight into this theory of knowledge. I'm Peter McGuire, and this has been my unlikely explanation. I would be a very poor Coloradan indeed if I didn't spend a little time talking about DIA. Construction on the Denver International Airport began in 1989 to replace the increasingly outdated Stapleton Airport. Its troubled construction faced many delays due to poor planning, strikes, and several design changes necessitated by the expansion of the Nazi weather machine program. The four runways were laid out in a swastika, because that is the Nazis' favorite shape. Significant resources were spent developing an H.H. Holmes-style labyrinth of underground tunnels that primarily house alien spacecraft and biological weapons today. This expense was partially explained to the public as a complex and modern baggage handling system that never worked properly and was eventually scrapped. Chicano artist Leo Tangema created several murals depicting the rise and eventual hegemony of the New World Order, which he thinly veiled as depicting ecological and social rebirth consistent with his earlier work. It is unclear why the New World Order created art announcing its intentions in the highly trafficked public space above its secret lair. The baggage carousel is decorated with bizarre, grotesque statues, which are used in the Colorado style of design to indicate entry points to the subterranean realm of the Mole People. The airport reached its final form on February 11, 2008, when an enormous, fearsome statue of a blue Mustang was installed between the only roads in and out of the airport, such that no traveler can come or go without passing under its soulless gaze. Like a Philip K. Dick android, the statue killed its creator, Luis Jimenez, in 2006 when its head fell on him and severed an artery on his leg. Its glowing red eyes serve as a reminder of the primordial evil locked within.